From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Don't turn our tragedy into war. We'll hear a plenary of peace activists in Washington, D.C. as thousands took to the streets this weekend. And Merchants of Death, an interview with Tom Turnipseed on the weapons industry's rising profits. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Vowing to redefine patriotism, more than 20,000 peace activists rallied in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. over the weekend to mourn American terror victims and to urge the nation to work to heal the poverty and injustice that fuels global violence instead of focusing on military revenge. Speakers blasted all forms of violence and injustice, the killing of innocent civilians during wartime, the backlash against Arab and Muslim Americans, embargoes aimed at Iraq and Afghanistan, and a federal anti-terror campaign that threatens U.S. civil rights. In Washington, some 10,000 people demonstrated throughout the weekend in rallies originally called against the annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. A crowd of nearly 10,000 in San Francisco carried a giant, jug-eared President Bush puppet and signs proclaiming "Vengeance is not justice" and "Save American lives by stopping U.S. aggression abroad." In Brighton, England, thousands of anti-globalization protesters voiced their opposition to war in Afghanistan yesterday during a noisy but peaceful march on the first day of the Labour Party conference. And anti-war protesters took to the streets of Sydney, Australia. But the Australian Defense Minister told them that Australia is already providing the U.S. military with assistance and that Australian troops are already under U.S. command. Thousands also marched in Spain and Greece this weekend, some 5,000 in Barcelona, marched behind a banner that read, "No more victims, for peace," at a rally organized by the Let's Stop the War Committee. A statement of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, was read and loudly applauded. It described Taliban rulers as barbarous assassins, but pointed out they had once been financed by the United States. President Bush has approved a secret effort to strengthen a diverse array of groups opposing the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan, U.S. administration officials say. The aid is not only intended to help the Northern Alliance, the rebel group that operates from bases in northern Afghanistan. It's also aimed at stirring up resistance to the Taliban among Pashtun tribal groups in the south. Administration officials indicate that the assistance included financing, but they declined to explain how much money would be spent or to provide details of the effort. Funds would enable anti-Taliban groups to buy weapons, to recruit new fighters, and to bribe Taliban commanders to switch sides. Senior U.S. Congress members, Afghan opposition leaders, and a former king of Afghanistan, Mohammad Zahir Shah, met this weekend in Rome to draw up a post-Taliban political map of Afghanistan. The former king said he's prepared to lead an interim government in Afghanistan after the overthrow of the Taliban regime, but also told the Congress members he would prefer assistance from a multilateral body like the United Nations instead of the U.S. alone. The Taliban acknowledged last night they're hiding Osama bin Laden. The U.S. has named him as the prime suspect in the September 11th attacks. The Taliban said they are holding him at a secret location inside Afghanistan for, quote, his safety and security. The Taliban also stressed it's still prepared to negotiate with the U.S., but only if proof is provided that bin Laden is guilty of the attacks. The admission is likely to strengthen arguments in Washington in favor of an early military strike. The New York Times yesterday reported that the Central Intelligence Agency secretly began to send teams of U.S. officers to northern Afghanistan about 3 years ago in an attempt to persuade the leader of the anti-Taliban Afghan opposition to capture and perhaps kill Osama bin Laden. This according to U.S. intelligence officials. The CIA's clandestine efforts were part of a broader long-term campaign to destroy bin Laden and to kill him. The campaign continued unsuccessfully through the end of the Clinton administration and into the Bush administration. The British newspaper The Independent reporting that campaigns waged by terrorist organizations are being partly financed through protection rackets that extort money from respected large corporations across the world. Oil companies in South America and Middle Eastern airlines are among those paying to prevent their businesses being damaged, according to the magazine Forbes Global. It claimed under timber companies in Southeast Asia have also made protection payments, and until recently, a Jewish-owned bank was paying off the Lebanese Islamist group Hezbollah. An executive in the financial division of a state-owned oil company in southern Europe said that donating money to Islamic groups was a cost of doing business in the Middle East. And Israel on Saturday gave Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat 48 hours to enforce a shaky truce over Israeli soldiers killed almost a dozen Palestinians in a bloody weekend of protests marking the first anniversary of the uprising.
I heard you listening to a secret conversation. You were crying. You were trying not to let them hear you. I heard you listening in. Never mind what they want to do. You got a right to your point of view. It doesn't matter what they say.
You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting just blocks from where hundreds of rescue workers still are operating to take the debris away from the area that was once the World Trade Center. No bodies, no live bodies have been pulled from the debris in more than a week. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of anti-war protesters are in the streets this weekend, both in San Francisco and in Washington, D.C. Many of those in Washington, many anti-globalization activists, had planned to be protesting the World Bank and IMF meetings that were to take place this weekend. But after the September 11th terror attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, those meetings were canceled. But people reconstituted those protests to be a protest against war. And there were two major rallies and marches, one at Freedom Plaza, drew about 10,000 people. And the other, hours before on Saturday morning, was spearheaded by the anti-capitalist convergence. People marched through the streets. Riot police lined up along the route. And at one point, towards the end, when people were about to disperse, they penned in more than 1,000 protesters. In the first hour of today's program, we heard some of the sounds of the street from Democracy Now! in Exile producer Miranda Kennedy. And we are going to pick up where we left off with a National Lawyers Guild spokesperson describing the scene when the riot police moved in.
People have been unconstitutionally detained and arrested, and they've done nothing wrong. So it's a Fourth Amendment and First Amendment violation. If there isn't a legitimate basis for them keeping us, I think that the reason is that for at least the last year and a half, anybody who tries to engage in free speech activity gets harassed and intimidated by the police, and this is one of their favorite tactics for being able to do that to people. You know, we have a lawsuit going against them for the mass arrest on April 15th of 2000. We have lawsuits against them for misconduct during the inauguration. There'll probably be one, or there could well be one out of this, whether we bring it or someone else brings it. But, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that people have been unconstitutionally detained. Right now, we are moving towards getting a judge to order us to be released.
The cops over here say individuals can leave. You can't have any like group march, you know. Started over by Union Station, and we marched all the way to here in the street with them, police blocking the streets off as we came through. Now that's over, and for some reason they put a line of cops to kind of keep us in here.
Organized, but just kind of a spontaneous counter-protest against the people assembled here who display a kind of presumptive and reflexive anti-Americanism, an assumption that our government always acts wrongly in the world, which we don't believe. We support our government. We support our nation. We think our nation is the freest and most prosperous country in the world. And we believe that military action will probably be necessary to remove the Taliban and destroy Osama and his network. And so we wanted to come here and show our support and patriotism.
So what do you feel is the solution? I mean, there is a lot of talk about eking out the terrorists. What do you think will be done in terms of military action, or what should be done?
I mean, it's going to be a multi-level process. I don't have like all the sources of intelligence of the government. It seems to me that right now they're contemplating some kind of like ground troop, small teams. Once his location's been identified, they're going to move in and attack him. But that's my understanding from reading the newspaper. And then I think that's going to be combined with action against the Taliban. And it's going to be combined with a lot of economic pressure on other nations in the Middle East to root out terrorists in their nations, and steps against terrorists in European countries, and steps against their financial networks. So,
do you think that military action is necessary?
It is. I think it's necessary that we destroy Osama and as many of his associates as possible. And I do think that we should remove the Taliban regime from power in Afghanistan.
The Taliban has been oppressing the people of Afghanistan since 1996, but there's never really been much of a pressure on the U.S. government to remove the Taliban. I mean, now everyone is talking about how oppressive the regime is, so can you just address that?
No, it's a terrible regime, and I would have hoped that our government would have done more to remove it from power earlier. I think it was an error after, you know, we supported them in Afghanistan against the Soviet army. It seems like we kind of left the situation hanging. We just moved out. We didn't try to establish, at least, I mean, I don't think we're ever going to have a wonderful democratic government in Afghanistan. I mean, it doesn't seem like that's really a possibility, but at least we could have tried to have a government better than the Taliban. But at this point, I mean, there's been a lot of isolationist sentiment in the United States recently and a lot of unwillingness to engage other parts of the world. But, I mean, when we come under direct attack from people that are aided and supported by the Taliban, it's the urgency of removing the Taliban has increased.
An alternative to war is desperately needed to avoid a complete explosion of retaliation and another retaliation and more bombings in the United States and more innocent people abroad. The bombing of whoever did the attack on the World Trade Center, there's plenty of crimes that the U.S. is responsible for that would not justify it but can explain what happened. And those explanations are needed. And we need to understand what could have motivated people to do this. Not just their hatred, but their ideas, their grievances. No one's born a terrorist. No one's born a Kissinger or a Suharto, but they're created by like ideas that are old but that are held on to maintain power structures, to maintain alliances that can't work. They can't work in our world because we're on the edge of nuclear or chemical warfare, and it's too dangerous to allow it to continue. That's why a peaceful alternative is necessary. I think justice is necessary. I don't think that the United States has the moral authority to be the judge on what justice is at this moment. You know, they haven't signed on to the International Criminal Court in Rome. They haven't followed up credible allegations against their own officials, soldiers. So we don't have the moral authority. Others do.
I disagree with the United States' aggressive policy in the Middle East since World War II. You look at the numbers. You look at economic sanctions in Iraq. You look at bombs being dropped in Iraq this week, you know. The number of lives lost due to America's heavy-handed policy in the Middle East. I think that although to quote Howard Zinn, you know, although it was shocking what happened at the World Trade Center and at the Pentagon, I wasn't surprised by it. I think it's a backlash to a policy of terror that's been going on for a long time. I hope that the violence of the recent weeks will bring about change in the way that we approach foreign policy. I mean, I feel fear about the terrorist attacks, but I think that a slowness to react and an openness to communication is a better policy than dropping a bunch of bombs on Afghanistan. We're dealing with a lot of fear right now. I think that the police are really scared of what might happen when a bunch of people get together to voice opinions. This is an overwhelmingly peaceful protest. I don't think that there's any need for this amount of police coverage and action, you know? But I feel their fear. I empathize with their fear. I hope not to get clubbed.
I have difficulty seeing the American flag as a flag of justice and freedom. I see it more as the flag that's flown when the Marines invade Nicaragua or Santo Domingo. I see it as the flag that is flown, you know, from frigates and battleships. I think that the American flag has been desecrated by the government, by the state, in the second half of the 20th century. I think that we need to take it back to make it a flag for justice and for peace and for equality.
Sounds of the street of Washington, D.C. this weekend as more than 10,000 people took to the streets in the first major anti-war rally since President Bush in the nation's capital announced that the U.S. would engage in military action against, well, that's not clear who yet. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll go to the former state senator of South Carolina, Tom Turnipseed, who's done an analysis of some of the stocks of the weapons manufacturers. His piece is called Merchants of Death Make Money from Killing. And then we're going to hear two speeches that were given over the weekend, one by Reverend Graylin Hagler, longtime anti-war, anti-death penalty activist in Washington, D.C., and Connie Shulan of the American Kurdish Information Network, talking about the Kurds in the situation that we face today. Stay with us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No one ever can understand it. The way the system planned. There's no hope, no chance, no loophole, no escape for a sufferer man.
I just the way that the Babylon planet. For right to fight each and every one every day. I don't know.
Resistance.
Yeah.
I'm a
Putting up some resistance, Barris Hammond, here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As people mourn the losses of loved ones, and firefighters and others struggle to clear the wreckage of the World Trade Center, the weapons industry is gearing up for wartime-level profits. New York Times reports today that senior Pentagon officials say that the Pentagon is sharply increasing spending on intelligence gathering and accelerating purchases of reconnaissance planes. Pentagon officials say that much of the $18 billion they hope to get from a $40 billion emergency budget supplement authorized by Congress will be spent on intelligence and surveillance. Companies such as Northrop Grumman, which is developing a long-range unmanned surveillance vehicle and has invested heavily in electronic warfare systems, should benefit. Other contractors building the next generation of satellite-guided missiles and sensitive snooping devices also will play a role. The chair and chief executive officer of Quarterdeck Investment Partners, an L.A. investment bank that focuses on aerospace and defense, said this is a new war that will require new weapons. Well, we're joined right now by former South Carolina State Senator Tom Turnipseed, who's written an article for CommonDreams.org about how the weapons industry has already benefited from the attacks. And he joins us now. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Tom Turnipseed.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So talk about how you got your information for your piece, Merchants of Death Make Money from Killing.
Well, last Monday a week ago, I was just looking at the New York Times about the gainers. You know, everybody lost so much. The stock market went way down, 14.3%. The Dow Jones fell that week. The biggest loss since the Great Depression, and then folks lost more of their retirement, 401k retirement plans. It's the biggest hit ever on those. But a bunch of corporations made a lot of money. So we just got on the World Wide Web and found out who they were. And I already knew, but the top eight guys as far as making big money were folks in the weapons business. And they increased the value of their stock from 39% to 23%, those top eight, and they're all in the weapons business. And, of course, people hate, fear, and anger is the driving force for that market, and that's how they sell their weaponry, and that's what's happening right now.
Talk about the specific companies and what they're
going to
make.
I didn't do this past week. This is week before last. You know, the worst, the big, big, bad week. But one of them was Armor Holdings, Inc., which specializes in bullet-resistant vests and flak jackets to armored vehicles, and they sell them to the government agencies and multinational corporations. And then Grumman went up 21.2%, who they sell killing tools like the B-2 stealth bomber, warships, battlefield surveillance systems, and it's a $15 billion company with 80,000 employees. And others were Raytheon, which stands for the light of the gods, and I guess it's what it means in some language or something, but his stock rose 37%, and they sell 66% of the aerospace products to the United States Department of Defense. L3 Communication Holdings, Inc., whose stock gained 35.8% from America's loss. You know, everybody else's stock went down except these guys because they make specialized communication systems for satellite, avionics, and marine communications. And the United States Department of Defense accounts for 63% of this company's business. Then the EDO Corporation stock gained 24.8% during the week of war talk, and its products are used on land, sea, and in space, and they sell to the United States Defense Department 70% of their products and everything. And another one was Alliant Tech Systems, Inc., ATK, their stock soared 23.5% because they sell about 75% of their gunpowder, smart bombs, tank mines, and rocket propulsion systems and other war-making products to the U.S. government. And then over on the NASDAQ, a lot of these surveillance companies and security companies, their stock went way up. One of them, Envision Technologies and ICTS International, they rose 195.5% and 103.4% respectively. Another organization or a company, Visage Technologies, went up 175.8% because they develop biometric technologies such as face recognition and fingerprint imaging with instantaneous surveillance applications that have a bit of an Orwellian aura to me. But see, it's just the same old, and what bothers me more than anything else is the way these companies do business with our government in secrecy, and always have. And they just won't tell us, you know, what's going on, you know. And gosh, I think people right now are really demanding to know what's going on, because as we saw on September the 11th, American lives are at stake right here in the United States. And so we've got to be, you know, thinking about why. And I think that more than anything else, Amy, there's a silver lining to this terrible tragedy, in that for the first time in a long, long time, Americans are trying to finally wonder why we're so hated by people around the world, and particularly poor people in the Middle East. And this soul searching, I think, can be a good thing. And I think that it was just demonstrated. I was just listening to your interviews with the young people that rallied for peace in Washington over the weekend. You're going to see more and more folks that are involved in the peace movement, because there can be no winners in this thing that's going on right now. And all you got to do is just read the media and just read the New York Times over the weekend. It's a very, very frightening situation. And the cycle of killing is not the answer. It just can't be.
Tom Turnipseed, you're speaking to us from what, Greenville, Spartanburg area?
No, I'm down in Columbia.
In Columbia.
This is the state capital. It's where we had the big struggle over the Confederate flag. I think I was on your show a few times.
That's right. And we should point out, you yourself have an extremely interesting, unusual history with a father in the Ku Klux Klan. You yourself, a spokesperson or speechwriter for George Wallace when he ran his racist campaign for president, and then you completely turning around as an anti-racist
activist.
Yeah, about
30 years ago, I kind of saw the light, and when I did, I just went all out. I decided to devote the rest of my life to peace and justice work, and that's what I try to do, and I don't think there's anything any more important. I have a wonderful family, two children and two grandchildren now. When I look at my grandchildren's eyes, I just know that we got to keep working harder and harder, and I think, Amy, what we've got to really look at is why we're perceived the way we are in the world. And the recent dissing and ditching of all these treaties makes us really a rogue nation. And it started back in the Clinton administration, but it's continued and accelerated under President Bush, where we've, you know, walked away from just about unanimous consent on global climate change. We say, look, we want to drive our SUVs, and even though we're 5% of the world's population, create 25% of the stuff that causes the climate change and the global warming, and we stepped away from treaties on germ warfare, on international criminal justice, on rights of children, because we want to keep killing children. Us in Somalia, the only two nations that oppose the rights of children stuff. And, you know, it's a long list. And then racial justice with our walking away from the conference in Durban. And so I think it's a time for soul-searching by people in the United States who are interested in peace and justice and interested in the future of their families and loved ones and in the continuation of the human species.
Tom Turnipseed, being in the South, do you think there is a different reaction to what you're hearing in the North to the attacks and also the military buildup that we're seeing now?
Well, the South, is ever since we lost the Civil War, we wanted to show the world we like to fight. And so, and then a lot of the bases were put down here as part of the, you know, jobs and program and so forth. The military bases are all over the South. The old guys in the House and Senate had all the seniority, and they always put them on armed services committees and so forth and so on. So we're more militaristic, perhaps, but I see soul searching going on here. Our population is rapidly changing. We have a lot of Muslim folks that live in the South in the largest cities. Columbia is not that large of a city. If you take Atlanta and places like that, there's a lot of folks that live there, and a lot of these people are good friends and work with these folks, and it's very, very interesting about the religious stuff, Amy. I think more than anything else, I'm for the first time people are trying to learn about Islam and what a wonderfully diverse religion it really is. You know, when you look at the top myth of their faith is that Muhammad, the last great prophet, went up to heaven from the Temple Mount there in Jerusalem. They have a valid claim to the temple. The temple built by Solomon, the temple of the Jewish people in Jerusalem being a center of the Christian faith, he went up to be with the other great prophets that are recognized by Islam, including Jesus Christ, Solomon, and Abraham. So the Islamic people really have a claim to a more diverse religion than the Jewish religion and the Christian religion, which are, if you're not, you know, right with Jesus or right with Jehovah, you know, that's the whole deal. So Islam is a very, very diverse religion, and that's what we really got to remember. But we got to look real, real close at our American foreign policy and the foreign policy of the West and the Middle East, and what's happened to the people. We set in to quote stabilize the situation, and really all it was we didn't want the Russians coming over down into that area, you know, where all the oil is in Afghanistan, and that's how Bin Laden, at the age of 22, was recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency. He and his folks went up and fought in Afghanistan. That was his first, where he started fighting and so forth. And then the aftermath of that is the Taliban was set in power primarily due to our influence over
Well,
there.
Tom Turnipseed, we're going to have to leave it at that, but I thank you very much. And again, that U.S. connection to Osama bin Laden is not spoken about very much.
We need to very, very much. It's very important, Amy. And thank you so much for having me on this morning. I get real excited about talking, speaking up for peace, and I know a lot of other people are doing the same thing, and that's wonderful.
Well, thank you for joining us from Columbia, South Carolina, former South Carolina State Senator. You are listening to the War and Peace Report as we turn now back to this weekend in Washington, D.C., where there were major rallies in the streets of thousands and teach-ins throughout the weekend. On Saturday night at All Souls Church, the International Socialist Organization sponsored an event called Don't Turn This Tragedy Into a War. Among the people who spoke was Reverend Graylin Hagler, a longtime civil rights and anti-death penalty activist.
So good to see everyone here, and it's good to be here. I have to leave out early. I did something insane, like promising to go on the Fox Network with the O'Reilly factor, that right-wing person, and to talk about what we're about. And we know what we're about. One of the things today, for those who marched this afternoon, to see all of the numbers coming together, standing together, speaking out loudly and clearly against Bush's war machinery, speaking out loudly and clearly against the media trying to move the entire country into warmongering and hatred of those who are darker, of hatred of those who may be Arab, of hatred of those in other parts of the world. And we stood up. And we made a statement. It'll be very interesting to see how the media reports that there is a moral voice in this country. One of the things that Bush said, and you all heard it, he says, if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists. Well, we got news. We're not with you, and we're not with any form of terror either. We don't stand with terror in the U.S. perpetrating terror against somebody overseas. We stand with nobody who advocates terror. We stand with that which is right, that which is moral, that which is just. We advocate for justice for all people everywhere in the world, that everyone can stand up in a dignified fashion, have empowerment and the right of self-determination. One of the things that we know, all of us know the climate. And when he talks about you're either with us or you're with them, that's a tactic.
That's a tactic to force everybody who is a thinking person into silence and to allow the machinery to go forward. But I am so thankful that we are standing up. We have refused to be silent. We have refused to allow a moral voice to be taken away from us. We're standing up, and we will continue to stand and march forward because we know that this war and this proposition of war is unjust. It is immoral, and it is something that we don't stand for. When you think about the advocacy and the voices that we've been hearing, the voice talks about retaliation and revenge. And all of us know that to retaliate or to feel that you need to take revenge is a very irrational step. It's not rational. It's never rational. Because retaliation and revenge only leads to reaction, which is full of retaliation and revenge, which only leads to reaction, which is full of retaliation and revenge, and the cycle of violence continue to expand and to increase, and nobody ends up being safe anywhere in the world. If retaliation and revenge works, how come those who live in Palestine are still in conflict? Just think rationally about that. You have all of the weapons, you have all of the military, you have all of the finest missiles from the United States and all of the finest aircraft from the United States, and you react to every single thing, and your reaction somehow doesn't bring peace. It only gets worse, and it gets worse, and it gets worse. Obviously, it's irrational behavior. And so what we're talking about is responding to the situation as rational, moral people, knowing that you will never be safe as long as legitimate grievances around the world are not adequately and effectively addressed. As long as people continue to wallow in slavery or pseudo-slavery, as long as someone is manipulated by corporate interests, as long as somebody is held under the thumb of monetary policies, as long as people are removed from their homeland, as long as people are just uprooted at the whim of any corporate or government entity that is immorally put in place, there will never be peace. All of you are organizers, and you know one thing that is true. You cannot organize when legitimate grievances are being addressed. But when they're not being addressed, it creates a vacuum. And it allows anyone to step into that vacuum, whether you are an extremist or whether you are despotic, you can step into that. So people always act incredulous at us when we say, you got to address the issues of injustice around the world. And they said, well, how does that help us? Well, it helps you, you idiot, by dealing with the problems of people, and therefore people stop reacting in irrational ways, and your borders become safe, and their borders become safe, and your children are safe, and their children are safe, and everybody is able to enjoy the worth of their existence. It is no mystery. It is no mystery. Now, one of the things I proudly say this evening is I've preached this message in black congregations all over the city. And one thing I can say is that at least the black church community gets it. They understand. They understand that their moral gospel tradition says strange things like love your enemies, love even those who hate you. It talks about loving God with all of your heart, your mind, and your soul, and your neighbor as yourself. They take that seriously. And when that's there, you can't put it down because it's inconvenient. You only can wear it when it's inconvenient and when it's inconvenient, in season and out of season. If we're people, moral people of faith, I'd say to the people of the church, you got to stand in that tradition and hold it firm. And one of the things I want to remind you is that all of us, We need to get back to our spiritual religious values. The real values, not the Jerry Falwell values. Not the Pat Robinson, the real values that talk about the dignity and worth of all life, that talk about the beauty of all life, that talks about justice raining down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. We got to address that. And I'll sit down on this point, but I want to remind you this final point. One of the things that the prophet Amos says, and he says it very well. He says this. He says, when you sow the wind, you shall reap the whirlwind. What have we been doing but sowing the wind? When bombs drop down on Iraqis for the last 10 years, we're sowing the wind. When we sell weapons to despotic leaders and despotic governments to use against people, we're sowing the wind. When we allow economic policies to oppress people anywhere on the globe, we're sowing the wind. When we ignore injustice anywhere in the world, we're sowing the wind. And when you sow the wind, you shall reap the whirlwind. It is cause and effect, and that is where we are today. And we need to ask ourselves, how did we get here? And now, how do we get out of this situation? And it can only come by addressing the issues of justice in this world and lifting them up high and standing for that and that alone, that every one of God's creatures, every one of God's creatures, the entire rainbow, gay and straight and lesbian, all of us need to be treated with the dignity and the respect that we deserve. God bless you.
The Reverend Graylin Hagler, longtime civil rights and anti-death penalty activist, speaking at a forum against the war this weekend at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. When we come back, a Kurdish leader, Kani Shulam. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. Ani DeFranco, Amazing Grace, here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Kani Shulam, who is director of the American Kurdish Information Network, speaking at the anti-war forum this weekend on Saturday night. Don't turn this tragedy into a war.
I am a Kurd. I am from Kurdistan. I am from the heart of the Middle East. Was born probably 50 miles to the east of River Tigris. My own observations as a native of the region are probably can be viewed as I'm a patient, perhaps. When a patient goes to a doctor, a patient needs to talk. A patient needs to say how he or she feels. So I come to you in a way as a patient. As a troubled soul, as a hurt person, and I want to give you my perspective to that effect. This is perhaps the only crowd that I could say when the second president of this country said, when I think that God is just, I tremble for my country. This is your country. And I am a refugee in it, actually. What he said 200 years ago is almost valid today. Of course, he was referring to the issue of slavery. Thank God, the commerce in human cargo has come to an end. But we have other problems. As poets say, every generation has to fight their own battles. And this is our generation, and we have to fight our own battles. And we have to right the wrongs that have fallen on our lot. On September 11, I was at the vigil site. Two police officers came by and wanted to know if I had been approached that day or previous day by anybody, any strangers. I had no idea what they were referring to. I had been there by then for 191 days. They come often to check the permit to make sure I follow the rules. And then I asked them if I should have expected somebody, and then they did not really respond. But they did wear a very sad face, and I was puzzled. I didn't know why they were in that state. About perhaps 20 minutes later, I got a call that a plane had hit one of the Twin Towers in New York. And I turned on the radio, and I joined the rest of the nation in following the news. About perhaps 2 hours later, a person came to me, one of the pedestrians, and wanted to give me a hug. And I get a lot of reaction at the vigil site, some positive, some negative. I have to kind of be careful who the person is. And I felt positive, so I did give him a hug. But what I heard next was really very shocking, and that was that he wanted to give me an address, and he thought that the mob might take to the streets, and he thought that people of my color might be attacked, and he wanted me to have a safe refuge. I thanked him for his address, for giving me his address, but I was, in a way, shivering. Not from fear, but thinking about the fate of humanity and where we were going on its spaceship called Earth. Perhaps 2 hours later, another person came by, and he said, I've seen you here many times, and I know you're not an Arab, but I know many of my American friends do not really make a distinction between an Arab and a Kurd, and I strongly recommend that you fold and disappear, that you are asking for trouble. Again, it was another kind of a moment of truth, if you will, and your living history unfold in front of your own eyes. I did not want to fold. I continued. I have a friend who's helping me at the vigil site. At about 9:30, I went home to get him some food. When I came back, he was pale. And he said that we were just attacked. And he showed me the signs that had been knifed. And he said the person who attacked made a lot of angry comments. My friend doesn't speak English, but he heard the words Arabs, terrorists, airplanes, and you can imagine the rest. I did call the police. The police came, took a report. They told us to double up, and they said we are on our own. It's been 19 days now, I guess. 18 days. I'm usually there during the day these days. A lot of Kurds who were helping me earlier, some of them actually have not come forward, partly because they're afraid. They come from very societies that are very oppressed, so they have a fear of police, and then now they have the fear of the mob, if you will. It's very troubling to sit there throughout the day and hear people who, until 18 days ago, wouldn't even notice that you were there, would come and take a photo of General Sheridan, but would not even bother to say hi to you, are now telling you to go home. I don't know, it really holds a sad mirror to our values, to our society, to where we are, and where we want to go. How many more minutes do I have? I don't want to take too much time. The issue itself and the Kurdish component in the Middle East, I don't know. I mean, the first thing that came to my mind when the initial shock was over was the attack that took place in Halabja, a Kurdish city in northern Iraq, on March 16, 1988. Four airplanes dropped chemical and biological weapons on a civilian city. And in a matter of seconds, 5,000 Kurds dropped dead, together with their house pets, together with their chickens, together with their roosters, together with their goats, together with their donkeys. I don't know. I mean, I as a Kurd, as I preface my remarks to you that I'm a patient. As a Kurd, when I look at it, if our collective humanity had moved to the scene of that horrible, horrific, monstrous, abominable, blasphemous act, and if we had questioned the level of alienation, disconnect, misrule that exists in our world, we might have perhaps prevented what happened in New York and in the Pentagon. It's, from a Kurdish perspective, it's a very, very troubling world. I have heard Kurdish historians say, for the last 200 years, the guns have not gone silent in the Kurdish regions of Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria. Middle East, the birthplace of Western religions, the birthplace of Western writing, the birthplace of some of the earliest human settlements. In a way, I believe, maybe I'm favoring the place, we should revere the place. We should nurture it the way we nurture our grandmothers, the way we look after our grandfathers. That place gave us meaning, if you will, to see the world, to gauge it, to understand it. But today, it is a lab for the culture of violence. And that lab gets most of its wherewithal from the arsenals or the factories of the Western industrial, military, industrial complex nations. So the region, in a way, has become a black hole. The world, with the attacks on New York and Washington, has now, quote-unquote, discovered this. But the world has had its troubles, and we have simply decided not to see it. The media has managed to glue us to Simpson, to Lewinsky, to Condit stories. So we have to, in a way, look at it personally too, our own personal involvement with the problems that go on in the world. Elie Wiesel, the survivor, Holocaust survivor, says, "The opposite of love is not hate, but it's indifference." There is a big disconnect between Europe and the people of the Middle East and their aspirations and their hopes. There is a big disconnect between here and the Middle East and their aspirations and their hopes. We have to learn how to talk each other's language. We have to learn to relate, to engage. This business of dictating has to come to an end. People will not take it. You know, there's something called human dignity. There's something called for standing up for one's rights. And that has manifested itself in the past, and it will manifest itself in the future. I want to also come to the business at hand in terms of the postcards that you see on the chairs. It's a resolution that we have in the United States Congress. Turkey is the third highest recipient of the U.S. foreign aid. Turkey has 84% of its weapons come from USA. The resolution calls for the release of four Kurdish parliamentarians who have been in jail for the last 7 years and 209 days. I would strongly recommend it, urge you, plead with you to sign it, and so that we could collect it afterwards, and then we'll mail them to the appropriate Congress committee in the Congress, and perhaps they could take a step on it. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Connie Shulam is director of the American Kurdish Information Network in Washington, D.C. And that does it for our program. He was speaking at the Anti-War Forum Saturday night at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. A special thanks to Reem Kathuda, who recorded that for WBIX.org, where we can be heard along with WebActive.com. Also, welcome to the WFMU audience. WFMU at 91.1 in New Jersey is airing us every night at 7. And for those of you in the New York area, you can see Democracy Now! in Exile on CUNY channel. That's the all borough-wide channel, 75, midnight to 1 tonight, and then repeat it again from 4 to 6 tomorrow morning. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. Special thanks to our video team, Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Orlando Richards, who I know, Karen Renucci, Didi Halleck, Lenny Charles, Sam Delgado, and Tom Poole at Deep Dish TV. Thanks to our tech team, courtesy of New York Independent Media Center, and also to our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. Thank you to Pacifica Station KPFA and affiliate KFCF in Fresno. To all of our affiliates, we are Pacifica. In New York, you can see the program on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, channel 34 and 56, live. And you can see us at Free Speech TV, channel 9415 on the Dish TV satellite network. We're broadcasting from the historic firehouse at Engine 31, an exile from the studios of WBAI, Studios of the Band and the Fired. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.